Hi there, and welcome to the Proud to Be of Rust and Glass podcast. Today's guest is Pella Felton, who is a writer, performer, and scholar stationed out of Bowling Green, Ohio. As a lifetime actor and performer, Pella values the performance of her poetry much more than publication. On top of regular performances, Pella has featured in a TEDx talk from the Bowling Green Conference. We're going to talk about that a little bit more later. But first, Pella, it's so great to have you today.
It's so great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so I definitely want to talk about a lot of the incredible things you've been up to recently. But first, I want to start at sort of where you got started.
Well, I mean, that's a very expansive question, of course, because like arts have always and performance have always been part of my life. I did theater as a kid. I was in my first play 30 years ago. Oh. It was a production of Babes in Toyland that the Children's Theater of Charleston in Charleston, West Virginia did. And I was Inspector Marmaduke, the head of the Toyland Police.
Oh.
And I had a little handlebar mustache that like kept falling off during the production.
Is this documented via photo anywhere?
I am sure there are photos of it somewhere. I think there is because my sister was in it too, and she was one of the three blind mice. No. And then I think there's a photo of us together in front of the set. My whole family kind of took to it immediately, and it just sort of became the way that we, as the Felton clan, started to express ourselves. My father still does theater. He's running Spotlight this weekend for production of The Prom in Charleston, West Virginia. So, it is something that, like, it happened, and it sort of changed the way that we sort of interfaced as a family. And like I suddenly felt like as the weird kid, because I was always a weird kid growing up, I finally had a way to express myself where all the other kids had could like go play football or basketball or some sort of sports stuff. I suddenly had my thing. And as I've gotten older, I've expanded what that thing has been, okay. You know.
You've explored and discovered yourself.
And like what's interesting is I did theater for so long and then I kind of stopped because I wanted other ways to express myself. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of that has been finding other things like stand-up comedy, which I did for a very long period of time. I did a little bit of preaching. You know, I've done performance art. I've done podcasts. I did a podcast very similar to this show about a decade ago called That Conversation.
Oh, amazing.
Where I interviewed tons of artists in the Charleston, West Virginia area. A lot less bells and whistles than this. But like, I like talking. Mm-hmm. I like communicating with other people, you know. I love the sound of voices and just saying things and explaining things to people in the world. And so I've always sought out the ways to do that. And so poetry is just like the most recent in a long line of those. It's a tool that I like a lot because, as you said, I think it lives on the page, but it comes alive in rooms of people. Is that we've got so trained to think about the world in terms of objects, in terms of these perfect little things that can sit on our desk. And that's just not how my brain works. Right. Is that my brain, the thing that really sets me off, is this idea of the event and thinking about the world as a series of events and thinking about each poem as an event, as an experience that you and I can have. Mm-hmm. And I think that is sort of what led me to poetry. And so as a result of that, I think that I found it a little bit during the pandemic. I was teaching a class at a university that had a poetry unit in it. And it was a more universal performance thing. And so I realized that I needed to kind of learn how to write poetry. And so I just started dabbling in it. And it was sort of at the same time that I was coming out as a trans woman and I was looking for new ways to express myself. And poetry is extremely important in the queer community as a way to center feelings and ideas as truth or as research. Mm-hmm. And I was just very interested in what did it mean to center these small things that aren't given like the credit in more traditional types of writing. What is it to center these small experiences as research, right, or as truth?
So before that class and before those experiences that led to you starting to write that poetry, had you had an inkling to create and to write your own stuff for performance? Oh, or?
Yeah, I mean, when I was in undergrad, I did take some creative writing classes from, like, Sandra Mashburn is this brilliant poet. I think that she's retired now. The Mashburn Prize at the institution I went to, West Virginia State College, was named after her. And at that time, I was more focused on playwriting because I had come up doing a lot of theater in Charleston with this brilliant playwright named Dan Cady, who writes, produces, and directs his own work, completely self-taught, completely existing outside of the system. And that really appealed to me. So I was doing a lot of, like, really experimental poetry. Not even poetry as much as just, like, writing drama, short stories, and some poetry. Sandra, I'm really grateful. Sandra's the person that broke me of passive voice, I say, as I'm speaking in passive voice. But, like, yeah, it was always there. But I mostly saw myself until probably like 2012, 2013 as primarily a playwright before moving into these other spaces.
And then you kind of realized that you didn't have to be held to just that. And you had, sounds like you had a couple good examples of people, you know, going their own way and doing a bunch of different things. And you said, hey, I can do that too.
Also, playwriting is very hard to get produced. And directing theater is extremely hard. I've done it a few times. I enjoy it, but, like, also the reason that things that drew me to stand-up comedy and to poetry are those are technologies of myself.
Right.
I don't need other people to do that.
They're much more personal. You don't have to have the cast behind you. The cast is all in your head for that, right?
Right. And so, like, for years where I'm doing these brilliant plays that written by Dan Cady, I suddenly realize, hey, I can tell my story. What are the ways that I can tell my story, whether that be through podcasting or through poetry, which came a little bit later, or through stand-up comedy, and using my voice to give presence to things that otherwise would not get presence. And before I came out as trans, that was a little bit different because I did not have to speak for myself in the same way.
Right.
The stakes were not as high. And so, like, the things that I was doing and interested in before that were much different than they are now. But that desire to express myself was at the heart of all of this and continues to be at the heart of what I do.
That's amazing. So you mentioned connecting with family early on, which is incredible to have a family that's so like-minded and can really bond over, you know, what they're passionate about. You mentioned, you know, confronting and becoming you as a trans woman with your poetry and performance. Can you imagine a life without that performance, without that poetry as, you know, a tool for you to navigate things?
I mean, I can because I remember when I was not doing poetry, I was a lot angrier. I need to have some place to perform. For a long, long time, for about a decade, that was stand-up comedy. I did that for about a decade. I ran a show in Charleston, West Virginia at a bar that no longer exists because it burned down. And so, like, I needed that experience to get out and be around people and perform for them. And that event, yes. And, like, with poetry right now, we are so lucky in Northwest Ohio to have so many different opportunities on a weekly basis.
We do.
To be able to do that. That I'm grateful that I don't have to make that choice, but I don't know. Like, I've kind of pulled back a little bit. Like, I still try to go to one or two things a month, but, like, FOMO is kind of a dangerous thing.
Oh, yeah. Fear of especially when there's so much going on.
You can't, after a while, you realize you can't mm-hmm. go to everything.
You have to kind of focus on what you are willing to miss out on and what's really important to happen in your life. And
I missed so much stuff this weekend because I had had a very bad week last week where mm-hmm. a lot of kind of just stuff in my life mm-hmm. happened. And so
sorry to hear that.
It's okay. They happen.
No.
You know this.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And I got through it. But when I got back in town, there was a big reading at one of the local establishments, like one of the co-ops or something mm-hmm. here in Toledo. And I really wanted to be there. But then I was like, you are better off to your community if you don't run yourself ragged.
Right.
And so, like, self-care is part of the artistic process.
Rest and recuperation and resetting.
Yeah, I mean, especially as I've, like, began, like, hormone replacement therapy and my body is processing mm-hmm. things differently. And so much of my art is about expressing the experiences of my body mm-hmm. and somehow translating that for other people, that I don't think it would have been a good idea for me to take my body in that state. And that turned out to be true because I had, like, several, like, dizzy fainting spells the next day, and I was like, I'm so glad that didn't happen in public.
Right. Yep. You got to listen to your body sometimes. You mentioned it, and we've talked about it on this show before, but the Toledo area does have such an amazing arts scene, amazing performance scene that is just seems to be getting bigger and bigger every day. Can you talk a little bit about why you personally think that a scene like that and the people that are behind it are so important to a thriving creative community?
I used to teach a first year experience class, and one of the lectures I would give every year was on community, mm-hmm. and this was for like all the art students at West Virginia State College would all come in through my class because we're a very small university, and one of the things that I would tell them is, if you build the art around the community, you will fail. But if you build the community around the art, you have a shot.
Right.
Because
it's a great way to put it.
Because for a community to exist, there needs to be some reason for that community to exist.
Something bonding people together, yeah. Something bringing people to the table day in and day out. And
right. And like I came from an experience at a time. Because I've been involved with, like, nonprofits and arts in West Virginia for, like, 20 years before I even moved to Ohio. Mm-hmm. Like, my roots with, like, going into the trenches on mm-hmm. things mm-hmm. like film festivals and community projects goes deep. And so I encountered a lot of organizations that existed because the organization existed.
Right.
And it was not always clear what the purpose of the organization right. is. And
we know you exist, but why?
Yeah, and you have that in every community. mm-hmm. And there are always communities and spaces that I think can readjust their mm-hmm. focus and figure out and always say, well, why are we here again? Mm-hmm. But what I've found in Toledo is that there is so much less focus on organizations and like the purview of organizations and more focus on the event and foregrounding the art itself. Mm-hmm. Like, I know we've talked about her many times on this podcast before, but people like Johnny McIntyre, who is the Lucas County Poet Laureate, and she is not focused on Lucas County Poet Laureate as an organization. She is so focused on partnering with other people and bringing mm-hmm. other mm-hmm. people together. I was putting an event on a couple months ago, and someone from another organization was trying to understand. It's like, well, yes, but who's sponsoring? It's like, no, it's just an event. Right.
We're just getting together for the sake of poetry, yeah, for the sake of camaraderie.
You don't, and so, like, the affiliations mm-hmm. are less important. I think when you have a large enough population and you have enough people, and, like, I think that nonprofits serve a really important purpose. However, I think that a lot of the culture, particularly younger artists, have moved away from that model.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are kind of distrustful when you say, come to a gala for the National Art Institute of da 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 da. And so I think that what Toledo does extremely well is it creates opportunities for people to come together that are about the art. Mm-hmm. That's what I love about things like the Momentum Art Festival, is that I've been to arts events in other places like that before, but that one is so focused on the artists. Mm-hmm. It is telling Toledo about what's already going on there, right, rather than asking artists to conform to someone's idea of what Toledo should be doing.
Right.
And I think that is why people keep coming back. If they kept asking us to keep coming in and drawing murals to match whatever vision the mayor has or whatever project like Ohio Arts has for a single year, it wouldn't exist. But because we have this experience of wanting to come together, hang out, create art, we're able to engage mm-hmm. with those projects as part of our larger experience of the art that's already here.
Oh, yeah. And the most important part of that is creating art to our own unique voices, too. You mentioned murals. If you look at the murals around town, you can tell each different individual artist, there's their touch, there's their style. They, for the most part, I mean, there's always going to be murals that are a little bit more dictated as far as what can be drawn. But most of them, you can say, like, hey, that came from a place of heart and a place of love.
Yeah, I want to make clear, I love murals. Mm-hmm. My aunt is a mural. The artist BZ Tat is a mural artist in Canton, Ohio.
Oh, that's really
that
cool.
Does a lot of really amazing work there, particularly with community mm-hmm. and with people of different mental health situations in the community. So I don't want to come off as anti-mural.
Oh, no, absolutely. I don't think you did at all.
I just picked an art form that I have no experience
right.
with.
Yeah, I'm always a little impressed because this is completely off topic, but I can barely put together a coherent picture on a 8x11 piece of paper, and you see some of these massive, intricate, beautiful, symmetrical artworks, and it blows my mind.
Well, honestly, that's how we find our art, is we fail at the things that we're not good at.
Right.
Yes, I found community theater in 1994, but it was after my parents tried over and over again to find things that I was good at. Like, well, can't really roller skate, but not really a drawer. Like, well, let's just keep trying until mm-hmm. they find something, and we hit the jackpot with theater. And I love theater, and so it became part of my identity. But I don't know. I've wanted to experience more things.
Yeah, and it sounds like you've tried a lot more since then, too.
And there's stuff that we won't have time to get to in this conversation, my film exhibition stuff and some mm-hmm. of my activist work. Mm-hmm. But why do just one thing?
Right.
So when you asked me for a bio, I was like, well, who do I want to be today? Because I don't one of my big things, and I don't know if you've watched the TED Talk. You are who you define yourself mm-hmm. to be. You're allowed to be any version mm-hmm. of yourself as long as you can get up in the morning mm-hmm. and look at that version of yourself.
Right.
And that was a very hard lesson for me to learn, because a lot of choices that I made in art were made because I was trying to please other people.
Right. I think it's a lesson a lot of people learn a little too late, too, so it's good. But so you just casually dropped TED Talk. Pella has actually done a TED Talk. I've always been a fan of what they do and the broad range of topics discussed in TEDx and TED Talks, and you got to do one.
There are so many. It was the scariest thing I've ever done.
Can you tell us a little bit about how that happened for you and about that experience?
The Marvin Center at Bowling Green State University does every year they do a TEDx. Talk. They do a series of talks. They do a TEDx conference every year, and they accept applications usually in November and December.
Okay.
And it had always been on my bucket list, and I had hit so many of my bucket list things. I was like, now is the time. Mm. And I knew that I wanted to talk about trans issues. And in 2022, I'd come up with this idea. I was reading a bell hooks article. I was reading the introduction to Bell Hooks' book, Black Looks, and she was talking in there about the frustration of students not being able to see the possibility for black joy and black love. And I was thinking about that in terms of my experiences as a albeit white trans woman, and how there wasn't an infrastructure and there wasn't an intellectual way to talk about trans women loving themselves. Mm-hmm. We had words for hating trans women, like trans misogyny, but we don't have any words. And I'm a big believer that you can't experience something that you don't have the language for.
Right.
And so I came up with this word transphylogeny as a way to sort of theorize my body, my experiences of my body. And then I wrote a little proposal, and they accepted it. And it was the most stressful 6 weeks of my life, because I knew that on some level, once I went on that stage, my life was going to change, because mm-hmm. it means one thing to present yourself in public to your friends and family. Mm-hmm. My body is always going to be political because I'm not conforming to traditional gender norms. As a transgender woman, I accept that. It gets to a different level once you place yourself on a stage for other people to say
for
that.
An incredibly wide audience. And
yeah,
as you said earlier, that raises the stakes, doesn't it?
Yeah, when you're doing theater, you can hide behind a character.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little bit of a distance between you and mm-hmm. the person. When you're doing stand-up comedy, you can hide behind, yeah, but it's also a joke. When the poetry, a little bit less that.
Mm-hmm.
But like also most people that go to poetry readings don't actually care about the performance. In my experience, mm-hmm. they should. But when you are up there and the thing that you are performing is yourself, it is as naked an experience as I had. And it was something that I was living with this anxiety about. Mm-hmm. Because then you have to put it on the internet, which right. is a much less kind space.
It's a nasty space.
When you like the
people are very bold online. People are bold and they don't think there's consequences for their boldness. And
yeah, and I've had some run-ins with some really terrible people that have mm-hmm. like targeted me because of that talk.
Mm-hmm.
And it like the philosopher Peggy Phelan, who's this performance philosopher, is big onto the idea of like the ontology of performance versus what we see as performance reproduction, is that when you are in a physical space performing for someone, you are in control of their experience of you mm-hmm. on some level. You decide what they see mm-hmm. for how long. Mm-hmm. You can literally walk away. Once that body has been captured by media, you lose control mm-hmm. of that performance.
It's no longer yours.
It's no longer yours. It is a metaphor for you.
Mm-hmm.
It is a metaphor for you, and you have lost control. And that was the most terrifying thing about this. It's like it's something I think a lot about. So I worked a lot with the Marvin Center and with TEDx. We ultimately, after some really bad stuff happened, in October, we decided to turn off comments on my talk. So mm-hmm. anyone that watches that, I'm sorry that I really, really sorry that you can't engage with it in that particular way. But on the other hand, I've had people that have come up to me and told me, my spouse showed me that talk. And, you know, I'm identify as a cis male, but I am gender nonconforming. And it really meant something to see someone willing to say all of these mm-hmm. things. My ex-wife's sibling came out as trans about the time that talk. And my ex-wife called me to tell me that their talk had, number one, given them some closure about our marriage, but also helped them understand their sibling more.
Mm-hmm.
And so it kind of has turned into... my colleague, the trans poet, Barbara Minney, calls herself a quiet activist. And I'm not quiet, so I'm not going to pretend that. But I love that idea of like activism, where you don't always have to say something all the time to be an activist.
Right.
Sometimes your body is enough. And like, I don't get to control all the time how other people interpret my body. But this was one case that has sort of been archived on the internet
mm-hmm.
where I can take control and say, this is what I think my body means. Mm-hmm. This is how I am performing myself. You can go and do with that what you will. But I've created this one word, transphylogeny, the affirmation of trans femininity and trans womanhood as a way to explain myself to the world. You can take it or you can leave it. And people have done both. And it's really terrifying, but also gratifying.
Yeah. I hope the gratitude and I hope the positive outcomes from that have outweighed sort of the nastiness and that negative feedback you initially received.
So. Well, what's funny is that like Twitter mm-hmm. is so bifurcated right now and the internet is so isolated that I didn't even find out about like this heinous attack by mm-hmm. this woman who goes after trans women until about 3 or 4 weeks later, mm-hmm. I logged onto Twitter or X or whatever it's called now for the first time in a few months. And I just see this cascade of vitriol. Mm-hmm. And I start looking in my private messages and it's like, I'm so sorry for what's happening right mm-hmm. now. Mm-hmm. And I was like,
they always say, don't read the comments.
Yes, but like when the comments become the entire content, mm-hmm.
That's fair.
The thing that happened in my lifetime as an artist, as my adulthood, is we went through this whole arc of participatory media. Of when I was at film school at Syracuse was right when YouTube was hitting. Mm-hmm. And so many of my friends and many of the ethos that I had around creating things was based on this exchange of ideas and this exchange and this idea that anyone can really communicate with anyone. It's not just these artists on the hill. It's not just these philosopher kings that sit on the top of a hill quoting Hegel or something mm-hmm. and said anyone can be a part of the conversation. But the problem is anyone can be a part of the conversation. Right. So I think places like this, I think things like Voices Around Us do a good job of re-empowering the people that feel like the systems that were supposed to empower everyone to speak have made it harder for their voices to be heard mm-hmm. in this surus of confusion mm-hmm. that the internet sort of become. So like I was grateful to get to do the TED Talk. I just wish that it could have gone into ecosystems that were a little bit more healthy for it.
Right. That totally makes sense. And that's kind of what we're trying to do here. And I really do appreciate you sitting with me here and being part of that voice and that story that we're telling through Proud to Be of Rust and Glass. Is there anywhere that anyone can follow along with you? Or is there regular spots that they can come check out a performance?
I mean, there's always a lot. I'm kind of a more private person than I used to because mm-hmm. I'm going through a lot of changes in my life right mm-hmm. now. A lot of spaces that I used to occupy, I'm no longer occupying. So I think probably the best place I would recommend people to the TED Talk first because mm-hmm. That's a really good, interesting place. I am on Instagram and Facebook, but I'm not as public facing on those. You can roll the dice and send me a request on one of those and try to guess what kind of mood I'm in on whether or not I'm going to accept it. But like if you go to spaces like the Uncloistered Poetry Readings, other things in the community, I'm usually around. And there will be more things in the future. I'm not – like I've gone away from a lot of the spaces that I had been in. I think I mentioned before that I've left the ecosystem of Bowling Green State University. But I'm going to reappear in a completely different place in a completely different form, and someone will always be encountering that mm-hmm. form in some way or another. So, I mean, find me.
I love it. Well, we look forward to seeing what that next form, what shape that takes place in. And again, thank you so much for taking the time to come chat.
Curtis, it's been a pleasure.
I know we could talk for hours and hours and hours, but we will do that at another time in another place.
I mean, I could talk for hours and hours and hours. This is the most concentrated conversation I feel like you and I have had, yeah. which is one of the pleasures of this process mm-hmm. is that like, Curtis does a lot for the community that doesn't get a lot of credit. The Of Rust and Glass publishing has been a really important part. I said that I don't value publishing as much as performance, but also publishing is also how people discover your poetry and experience things. Mm-hmm. And so I've been really grateful as the only person that like publishes my stuff right now, Curtis. And I'm not even convinced you like all of the things of mine that you've published. But I appreciate this, you seeing the swings that I take.
Yep, absolutely.
And that I appreciate the creativity that goes into the different ways that you are structuring the book itself. Mm-hmm. Is that like there's a lot of swings that you're taking with formatting of these magazines that I really appreciate as well.
Thank you. I do that because I am terrified of performing. So.
But see, not everyone has to be known in that way.
Right.
I think that the people that are want to be known will always find a way. And the people that want to express themselves without being known will go into publishing.
Absolutely. It's a great way to look at it. So, well, thank you again, and I look forward to our next talk.
I do too as well. Take care, Curtis.
You too. This has been today's episode of Proud to Be of Rust and Glass. Truth is an underrated virtue, especially being true to oneself. This is even more difficult when you tell your truth to the scrutiny of the public eye, a public's eye who may not agree or even accept who you are. That said, we're grateful to have had the opportunity to learn more about Pella today, and we look forward to finding out what she does next. I am your host and producer, Curtis Dieter. Our executive producer is Chris Pfeiffer. If you want to join the conversation, check us out at wgte.org/rustandglass. Until next time, thanks for listening. Now go forth and create.
WGTE. Voices around us.
WGTE is supported in part by the American Rescue Plan Act funds, allocated by the City of Toledo and the Lucas County Commissioners, and administered by the Arts Commission.